This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome back to Science with Dr. Carl. My name is Lucy Smith and I am obsessed with this week's episode. We were joined by Kirsten Banks, astrophysicist and science communicator. You might know her on Instagram and TikTok as Astro Kirsten. She answered our questions about the solar eclipse, why people couldn't take off their glasses. We learnt about a thing called the potato radius and her favourite constellation based on First Nations astronomy. So much to get into. Let's do it. Carl is with you as per usual, but Carl, this week we have a very special guest.
We have a very special guest, almost doctor, Kirsten Banks, who's an astrophysicist who deals with the really big stuff, but unfortunately has to deal with the stupid quantum stuff because that's part of the big stuff. And she has got not one, not two, but three mugs, Kirsten Bank mugs, which have got her own papers. And there's a thing in when you write a scientific paper, are you one of the many, or are you the first author? And she's got three papers with her as the first author. So she has three Kirsten Bank first author papers.
Congratulations.
And she's almost going to get a PhD.
Almost doctor. Just waiting to hear back from reviewers to, you know, judge my thesis. Hopefully they say nice things.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kirsten, you're someone that I've seen on ABC News Breakfast. You've also got a TikTok profile where you answer questions on the regularly. Mm. What is one thing you've learned recently that's kind of blown your mind a little bit?
Oh, my gosh. Recently,
yeah,
I was reading this paper about – I know, nerd. I was reading this paper about how 1 in 12 stars have eaten their planets.
What?
Yeah.
The star has eaten the planet. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
Ingested its planetary offspring.
How is it? So, therefore, the star is bigger than the planet, obviously, or not?
Stars are always bigger than their planets.
Okay.
I would be quite shocked to find planets that are bigger than their stars. That would be actually quite a shocking
maybe
thing.
Maybe a red dwarf, but we won't even go into that.
We won't go into that. But, no, so these scientists look at twin stars, so stars that are born together out of the same cloud of gas. With that being the case, they should have the exact same composition. But these researchers found that some of them had slightly different compositions because they had eaten their planets.
How do they even find that out?
Oh, it's astonishing. They use this telescope, well, not quite a telescope, but a space probe called the Gaia space probe. It's out there monitoring stars all throughout the galaxy. It's monitored over, I think, 2 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy to date, which is astonishing. And by using that, they're able to find these twin stars that are born together and then use other telescopes to analyze their spectra, so their light stretched out into a big rainbow, looking at the patterns, and there's very slight different patterns due to planetary ingestion.
Oh my gosh.
So they've eaten a star, a planet, which might have a lot of silicon, mm-hmm. and they can pick up. So if you get silicon and heat it up, suddenly it gives out a peculiar light that says, I'm silicon. And it's very, very small, like the ratio of mass of our planet, Earth, to our sun, is 1 to 1/3 of a million. And they can pick up that tiny bit of silicon and say, oh, my God, 1 in every 12 stars seems to have eaten a planet. On the other hand, this is only if, like Kirsten and I, you have been bought off by Big Globe, because the flat Earth people are quite convinced that there are no such things as stars and moons and planets and suns, but rather they're all a thing called a luminary. They're all the same. And astronomers are just part of the big lie, claiming that there are differences between this and that.
I'm still waiting on my check, Big Globe.
Yeah, Big Globe.
Where's my check?
So we're going to be getting science questions from Dr. Carl. I can see some coming through about windmills, about cryogenic freezing. Ooh. But Kirsten, what kind of questions could you speak to this morning? It's been a minute since you've done the science segment. Mm. So what do you reckon you want to tap into?
Oh, look, my specialty is definitely all things space. Love space. Any sort of curly questions about the universe, I'm welcome to them. I can't guarantee that I'll be able to answer everything, but we can have a good time trying to figure it out together.
Absolutely. 0439757555. We'll start in Nam with Jim. Jim, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Kirsten. Hi, Dr. Carl. My question is, I saw some scattered news about the calculations for the Hubble constant maybe being brought into doubt. It made me think, what exactly is the Hubble constant? And are any of these details about a miscalculation significant?
Jim, great question. So the Hubble constant, to start off with, is this parameter that explains how fast the universe is expanding and the acceleration of that expansion. So it's currently set at, well, I'll say one number because, like you said, there is this tension. There are different numbers around there. But the current number that always comes to my head is about 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So essentially, if you are one megaparsec away, which is about 3.2 million light years away, if you're that far away, that part of the universe is expanding away from us at 70 kilometers per second. Then if you go 2 megaparsecs away, so 6.4 million light years away, that part of the universe is expanding away from us at 140 kilometers per second. As you keep getting further and further away, farther parts of the universe are expanding away from us even faster. But now, onto this tension. Many years ago, a couple of decades ago, we were pretty confident that the number was around 60 to 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. But as we have more methods to measure this constant, one way is by looking at supernovae throughout the universe. Another way is by looking at the afterglow of the Big Bang called the cosmic microwave background. And using these two different methods, these numbers have started to diverge. And it's caused this little controversy within the scientific community where which one is correct? Why is this tension? Everyone is so tense about it. And then comes along JWST, fantastic new telescope out in space, taking incredible photos of distant objects. It has also been used to look into this Hubble tension. And some researchers using JWST have said it has increased the Hubble tension. But a recent paper that might be coming out soon is also saying, well, actually, we may have solved it. So we're really on the forefront of knowledge at the moment, Jim, trying to figure out, is this actually a tension anymore? It is currently, but we're waiting on some new research to see if it's solved or not.
And scientists really like stuff when they don't know what's going on, because if it just turns out to be simple, oh, your measurement method is different from ours, okay, we solved it. But if it's leading to a new breakthrough and suddenly all the old physics has to go and there's a new physics coming, that's what the scientists really want. They want these breakthroughs. And then, of course, there's that weird coincidence, but I don't think it's a coincidence. You're saying around 60 or so, 70 kilometres per second. Well, 67 kilometres is roughly equal to 42 miles. And there was that book, 42, The Universe and Everything. I'm just putting it out there, 24 hours in a day, 24 slabs in a can, 24 cans in a slab of beer. Is it a coincidence? There's something going on. Maybe big astronomy has bought you off as well.
Mm. Again, where's my check?
Yeah. We've got Cameron in Sunbury here. Cameron, what's your question?
Hey, doctors. So, a bit of a generic question. If people and pets can get, like, the common cold and cough, can bugs get them too?
Yep. Nature is bloody in tooth and claw. Nothing personal, but everything wants to survive, and it wants to have babies. And if that means attacking big things like elephants, smaller things like fish, and even smaller things like insects, they all can be attacked by something smaller than them and bigger than them. But on the other hand, I like to think that we've made life better by having babies and unicorns and sunsets.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, pretty well any creature can get an infection from any other creature.
Wow. Thanks, Cameron.
Okay. That's cool. Thank you.
We've got Wayne here. Dr. Wayne, you've got a question about eclipses.
Yeah. G'day, doctors. I'm wondering if planets with lots and lots of moons have lots and lots of eclipses.
Great question. Yes and no. So an eclipse is essentially when a moon or some sort of object passes in front of a star or a sun, blocking some of its light from our perspective. Now, we're very lucky living on the Earth in this current age with our moon in the perfect spot and the perfect size to completely block the sun every now and then. We just had a total solar eclipse in America just 3 or 4 weeks ago, which I'm very upset that I missed it. I couldn't travel over there, unfortunately. But yeah, we're living in a very special time where it's the right size and the right distance away from us relative to the sun, which is also the right size and the right distance away from us. It's all a little bit too perfect, which is exciting. But if you're on a planet like Jupiter, which has 95 moons around it now, as far as we're aware. We could find more. We recently found more around Saturn as well. It's at 146 moons, which is incredible.
Yeah.
But those ones aren't necessarily big enough, Well, all of them aren't big enough to completely cover the sun from that perspective. Mars also, there was a great photo I saw the other day from Mars seeing an eclipse of, I think it was either Phobos or Deimos, one of the two moons around Mars, slightly eclipsing the sun, but not perfectly eclipsing the sun because they're just a bit too small. But I would say, yes, you could still see lots of annular eclipses, so ringed eclipses.
And you've only got 50 million years before the moon retreats from the Earth so far away at the rate of 4 metres per century that total eclipses will no longer be possible. So hurry up and move and go and see a total eclipse. It'll blow your mind.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Wayne,
thanks
for that.
We'll have to do that, okay?
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah, we've got your questions coming through on 0439 757 555. Kirsten Banks joining us talking space, and Dr. Carl, well, you can speak to pretty much anything, can't you?
But not the same depth about red giants that Kirsten has.
This is why I did do a whole PhD thesis on that, so.
We get our experts in for this reason, okay? Nathan from Newcastle, what's your question this morning?
Hey, good morning, doctors. I was just wondering, if you could stand on Jupiter, would you be able to see Saturn with the naked eye?
Oh, absolutely, Nathan. Whoa. Absolutely. Saturn is a very bright planet. It's very big. Excuse me. Very, very big. It really changes me. I remember seeing the first time Saturn through a telescope and seeing those gorgeous rings.
Oh, doesn't it blow your mind?
Oh, absolutely. And if Saturn is on the same side of the solar system as Jupiter, it would look even better through a telescope if you're on Jupiter because you're closer to the planet.
And just as a little aside, Galileo really shook things up when he used the recently invented telescope to look at Jupiter and see that there were four moons. And before this, they thought, these objects are, in inverted commas, air quotes, perfect, and therefore they exist by themselves. And suddenly you saw them and four other little lumpy bits. Now, here's the weird thing. An eagle has sharp enough vision to see the four moons without a telescope.
What?
Well, their job is to find something smaller than them a long way away and then fly to it and kill it and eat it. And so they need sharp vision. Nothing personal, it's just business.
All right, thanks, Nathan. We've got Andy from the Blue Mountains. Dr. Andy, you got a bit of a different question this morning. What is it?
Good morning, doctors. I'm just wondering if any of you have any podcast recommendations.
So what kind of podcast do you like, Andy? Because you do like scientific, educational kind of podcasts, right?
Yeah, so there's a few that I listen to on the regular, like Do Go On, the Infinite Monkey Cage and that. So like your scientific, educational sort of podcasts, if you have any recommendations.
Dr. Carr, we'll start with you.
Of course, I'd always listen to the Kirsten Banks podcast, if there are any.
I'll have to make one.
Okay,
okay.
And then firstly, More or Less, M-O-R-E or less, it's by an economist, and they just look at numbers.
Yeah.
And I kind of like insurance people and mathematicians because what you see is what you get. Also, of course, there's Nature and Science. There's my own one, of course, Triple J one, and there's the other own one, which is Shirtloads of Science, the Skeptoid, the Skeptoid. He specialises in busting myths, and it's all given there as a transcript and references, and also Wendy Zukerman. Wendy Zukerman, Science Versus. And she blew my mind with this one about dreaming. I had no idea that you basically dreamt through the whole night. And I thought, come on. So I went to the references and blow me down. I was wrong and she was right. How's that for a bit of a start, Dr. Andy?
All right. So we got
that
Kirsten.
Wonderful.
You've already got a list there, Andy. What about you, Kirsten? What do you like to kind of tap into?
Well, Andy, you already mentioned the Infinite Monkey Cage, which is definitely one of my favourite science podcasts, of which I was also a guest on at one point, which is very exciting. Peak of my career. I love the way that with podcasts like theirs, they have experts on to talk about their expert fields, but also people who are there to ask the questions that may seem silly, but there are no silly questions, because if you're not understanding what some scientists are saying, ask the question and figure out what's going on, because everyone deserves a chance to understand science. And I think they do that really well on the Infinite Monkey Cage.
And that's a really good point. If you don't understand anything that somebody says to you, don't think, oh, God, I am so stupid. What you do is you say, I don't understand. Can you explain it? And suddenly you get 4 years of knowledge in 3 minutes.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay, well, if you subscribe to the Science with Dr. Carl podcast. If you're not, you should be. But if you are, we will chuck these in the show notes of this episode. Andy, thanks for your question.
No worries. Thank you, guys.
We've got Graham on the West End. Graham, you've got a question about dizziness. What's going on?
Good morning, doctors. I was trying to understand why, if you just shake your head, like you're saying no, you don't get dizzy at all. But if you spin, you very quickly get dizzy and maybe even fall over.
There's two elements to it. You have different ways of measuring balance where you are, and you kind of think of a bicycle wheel with a whole bunch of spokes coming into the centre. Now, make that three-dimensional. You've got a hollow ball, and there's a whole bunch of spikes coming into the centre, and in the middle, there is a little ball. And depending on which hairs it rests on, you're leaning to the left or the right. That's kind of the system you got. You've got different systems. There's the semicircular canals.
Yes.
Look it up in Wikipedia, which are not semicircular. They're full circles. And there's three of them lined up at right angles to each other. So that's part of the mechanisms of knowing which way is up. When you are shaking your head left to right, that is a simple repetitive motion, a bit annoying, but simple, but the overall view of the world is the same. But when you do a full loop, you are now getting a mismatch between what your eyes see and your balance centres, and that's the thing that sets you off more. But then, of course, there's also the sense of proprioception, which is knowing where your body parts are, and we've done the experiment where you can, with your eyes shut, put your fingertip on your nose, and you can do the experiment where you get somebody in a room, and way down at the end of the room is a light, and you get them to point at that light with one finger on their right hand, and then you, dressed in black so as not to interfere with their field of view, you come up and you gently grab them by the wrist, and you make their finger describe, say, a clockwise circle around that light, and blow me down, their brain sees the circle doing an anti-clockwise circle. It will move through an anti-clockwise direction in space. So there's a whole bunch of things tied up with this whole dizziness thing. But the simple answer, shaking your head left to right is simple, although it's not simple, whereas doing a complete loop is more complicated, but of course it's more complicated than complicated.
I want to try that now. I can just imagine the circle or the light at the end of the room. There.
But you need another person, and they should be dressed in black so they don't distract.
They've got to be in their theatre blacks, their stage, yeah. Thanks, Graham.
Thank you very much.
All right, Nina, in Cleveland, you've got a question about the Earth and the Moon. What do you want to know this morning?
Good morning, doctors. My question, I was watching a documentary about the Moon actually being formed from the Earth, a collision with the Earth.
Mm.
So my question is, how are they both now spherical? Like, what is it that makes them spherical?
Great question, Nina. So you're absolutely right. Seeing that documentary, we had back in the day, maybe 4 million years ago or so, or maybe a bit earlier, I'm not quite sure on the exact timeline, but a Mars-sized object, which we call Theia, crashed into the early Earth, and the debris from that crash turned into the Moon, then you have the Earth as well. And we can prove this based on different soil or rock samples from both the Moon and the Earth. They have very similar carbon ratios in them. So that's that evidence that gives more weight to that theory of the Theia Mars-sized object crashing into Earth. Now, the reason why they're still both round after such a cosmic impact is because of a thing called the potato radius.
Love
potato
that.
Potato radius?
The potato radius.
I would like to say I've never heard those two words put together. And audience, please use them in a conversation in the next 24 hours.
Yes. Oh, yes, please do. So the potato radius is the transition from an object being oblong or potato shape to spherical in shape. And that radius is approximately 200 to 300 kilometres. Now, the Moon is just a little bit shorter or a little bit thinner than Australia, so much larger than 200 to 300 kilometres in radius.
Can you say that again?
The Moon is just a little bit skinnier than Australia.
What?
Yeah, fun little mind-blowing fact for you.
Yeah.
But since it's so big, generally things that are bigger than 200 to 300 kilometres in radius will more likely be spherical in shape than potato in shape.
Okay.
And does this vary if the object is rocky as opposed to icy, because in our solar system, which has many hundreds of moons, the only two large rocky moons, in other words, made of silicon atoms, are Io, a moon going around Jupiter and our moon. Everything else is either large and icy, like methane ice or helium ice or whatever, or small. So I'm guessing for icy it would have less structural integrity, but not necessarily.
Not so sure about that one. No. I did read a paper about this potato radius where it did discuss different regoliths, so different types of rocks and dust. But yes, generally it was between 200 and 300 kilometres because there's just so much mass and the gravity of that mass does form it and shape it into a spherical shape.
So what you're saying basically is gravity sucks.
Gravity really sucks.
And it sucks the blunty thing into round. And by the way, Nina, we've found, and this was an amazing discovery last year, two bits of Theia in the Earth. So you've got the Earth as it's got a thin crust, 60 to 70 kilometres thick, and then going down halfway to the centre, you've got molten gloopy rock, and then inside that is a ball of liquid iron. Sitting on top of the ball of gloopy iron at that boundary halfway to the centre are two lumps of Theia, each roughly the size of Australia, but hundreds of kilometres thick, one under West Africa, which is interesting, and the other one, they say in the paper, under the Pacific Ocean. I thought, hang on, that's a cop-out, because by itself, the Pacific Ocean is about half the surface area of the Earth and is bigger than all the land masses on Earth put together. So saying something's under the Pacific Ocean is like saying, well, it's somewhere on the other half of the Earth.
It's somewhere in the air, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere there. But we're very confident that these two lumps of Theia are sitting on top of the iron ball. And the way we found out was by analysing the waves from earthquakes travelling through the different layers of the Earth.
Oh, yes, this thing. Oh, my gosh, it is so cool. Sorry.
Please.
Yeah, absolutely. We can use earthquakes to map the insides of the Earth. We can also use star quakes to map the insides of stars, which was part of my PhD thesis. But back to this Theia thing. Yeah, there are these two big blobby bits in the mantle or in the parts of the Earth that we could find through earthquakes. Like, how bonkers is that?
Yeah, using them to, because that was going to be my next question. How do they even find these if they're so into the core of the Earth?
It's kind of like doing a CAT scan. So you do an X-ray of somebody. So I've got you in front of me. I've got an X-ray source on one side and an X-ray film receiver on the other side, and basically just go straight through and I pick up light and dark. And so you've got dark bits where your ribs are and your spine and light where flesh is. Yeah. But then suppose I take not just one, but I take one from in the front and one on the side, then I can put those together and get a very coarse image, and that's a simultaneous equation in two unknowns that I have to solve. That was a bit of mathematics. So when they do a CAT scan, they do tens of thousands of slices all the way around you, which means that they have to solve tens of thousands of simultaneous equations. Now, we don't have X-rays big enough to go through the Earth, but we do have the gravitation. We do have those earthquake waves going through the Earth. Mm. And so we plug that into the same program that we use for a CAT scan or an MRI scan, and we use that information plugged into your regular CAT scan program to give you what information about the inside of the Earth.
So we're making CAT scans of the Earth with earthquake waves.
On the other hand, but I don't know what flat Earth people would say about that
one. Yeah, okay. The jury's out on that one. Nina, thanks so much for your question.
Thank you. That was fascinating.
Yeah. Alex texting in saying, good morning, doctors. I'll be using potato radius all day now.
Yes, Alex. Very good.
Felix in Bendigo, you've got a question for Kirsten. What's up?
Yeah, morning, doctors. My question is, how exactly do you become an astrophysicist in Australia? Because I've been looking at it and there's been a lot of information on Google, and I'm about to start and finish my VCU properly because I didn't do it back when I was a teenager. And my plan was to do that and then do a Bachelor of Science and then a postgrad in astrophysics. So I was just wondering if I could get confirmation, I guess.
Love this, Felix.
Absolutely. I love this so much for you, Felix. So let me tell you my journey. I finished my HSC and then went in to do a Bachelor of Science with a major in physics at the University of New South Wales. Then from there, what I did also was an honours year. So it's kind of like a mini thesis over 1 year where you do some extra courses. I did things like astrophysics to be one of them, general relativity, and the usual quantum mechanics and stuff that I had to do, which I didn't really want to do because I like the big stuff, not the small stuff. But yeah, so going from the undergrad in science Bachelor of Science, major in physics is a great first step because you'll learn those really fundamental things and skills to become an astrophysicist. And then I went on after that to do my PhD in astrophysics. You can do a master's if you wish or a PhD, and that's a great direction and path into academia to be an astrophysicist, Felix.
Now, can I ask you, how important is it where you do your undergraduate versus your postgraduate research? Will any university do for undergraduate or in Australia and around the world?
Right. I would say it's really a personal choice of what university you go to. So I had choices of doing an actual astrophysics degree at Macquarie University versus doing a degree in science and major in physics at UNSW or even at UCID. But for me, for my personal choices, UNSW was the best fit for me. And I haven't regretted that choice at all. It's been fantastic academics there who have helped me throughout my journey. So I would say it's really a personal choice because who you're surrounded by in these what can be quite difficult and challenging times really makes a difference.
Sure. Yeah. It really helps if you don't have to have a job to earn money. You can stay at home. And you've got the maid at home and the butler to look after the dishwasher, making the bed, doing the washing, putting out the garbage, paying for the electricity and the internet. So it really does, in Australia, all the universities are still of a pretty high standard. So it doesn't really matter where you do it, so long as, I think this is fairly important, you get good marks. Like the marks that you can get are either fail, conditional pass, pass, credit, distinction or high distinction. If you get a distinction average through the university, at some stage they'll let you do anything you want and they'll call you in and they say, look, you've been doing well, why don't you apply for the ABC scholarship or the XYZ scholarship, which you never heard of. So they've got these little secret bags of money that they give to the students who do well. And unfortunately what that means is that being a student is a full-time job.
If
you are trying to earn money while being a full-time student, you really can't do it well. And I was very lucky that when I went through the systems, the Australian government thought that, I know this sounds ridiculous, they thought that education was a worthwhile investment in the future. I know, they wouldn't make that mistake now.
My HEX debt is going up in a month and I'm not happy about it.
Yeah. So I've had 16 years of university education for free, but you can go to Denmark. They will and Germany, and they will give you education for free in the English language. And in Denmark, they'll even give you money to rent a flat and buy a bicycle and buy food.
Felix, do you reckon you could go to Denmark or Germany?
Look, I don't even have a passport, so... But I'd love to.
Well, Felix, thank you so much for your question. And
all
the
best with your journey, Felix.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing what you do.
Thank you. And I'm watching you on TikTok as well. So.
Oh, thank you.
And ring me at the University of Sydney if you need any personal advice about, I can't help with clothing or relationship advice. I can help with academic advice.
And you know what? If you know someone who is approaching university study, send them this episode because it all helps. We've got Kel in Melbourne here. Kel, recently we had the solar eclipse. I saw videos of it from the US. What's your question?
Hey, doctors. So my question is, why can't we look directly at solar eclipses?
Oh, yes, a very important question, especially since we've just had an eclipse.
And you see the videos of everyone wearing, well, it looks like the sunglasses you get at the 3D movies.
Yes, but much more high-tech than the ones at the movies, so to speak. So those glasses have neutral density filters in them that filter out like 99.9% of light. So if you see them, if you put them on just on a regular day and it's cloudy, you're not going to see anything. But when you have them on during a solar eclipse or when the sun is out and you look at the sun, it's safe to look at the sun as long as they're not impacted in any way. But to get to your question, why is it dangerous to look at an eclipse before it's in totality? Is because in those final moments before totality, where it's starting to get dark, your brain's like, oh, it's dark now, so it must be safe to look at the sun. It's all good. But no, there's still even just the final percent. There's these little tiny bits of sunlight that can still get through right before totality, making what's called the diamond ring effect, which is beautiful. You have these Bailey's beads, but even just the tiniest bit of sunlight is going to be very dangerous for your eyes and can burn into your retinas. So only look at the sun during a solar eclipse when it's absolutely in totality. Don't believe your brain thinking that it's safe. Only look at it when it's safe.
Yeah. And the Google search?
Oh, yes. There was also in the recent eclipse on the 8th of April in the US, there was a spike in Google searches for "my eyes hurt," which is a bit concerning.
Oh, my gosh.
And in all the medical journals after every eclipse in well-educated areas where people are wealthy enough to go to a hospital and their country's wealthy enough to have an eye hospital, there's always photos of people with little crescents burnt into their retinas, which will stay there for the rest of their lives.
Good
They've
Lord.
Lost vision in that area.
It's crazy. Yeah, that's these poor people. My eyes hurt. Why?
Yeah. Also, why do my eyes hurt? Also peaked on the 8th of April too.
Kel, thanks for your question.
Thanks so much, doctors.
There's this great photo of Lord wearing her glasses as she looks up. She looks so cool in them. She looks great.
I love it when people make science look trendy.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. We've got Ellie in Werribee here. Now, Ellie, you're studying at the moment. What do you want to know?
I have a question, doctors. What would happen if we could harness the power of lightning and maybe use it as an energy source?
Ooh. Oh, funny. I wrote about that in one of my books, which works out like this. If you harnessed all the energy of all the 1.5 billion lightning bolts that happen each year, mostly in the tropics, 90% of them inside the cloud. If you harnessed all of that energy, that would give you enough, if shared out equally between everybody on Earth, enough energy to boil water for 2 or 3 cups of water a day. We are an incredibly energy-hungry society, and I discovered this as a drug-crazed hippie when I was living in the bush. If you want to have this thing called hot water, you don't just walk over and turn the tap. You've got to walk all the way down to the creek and then get the water and bring it back. And then you need another person whose full-time job is keeping the fire going. And so there's a lot of energy. We are an energy-hungry society. The advantage of this is we've got a much longer life expectancy, and we have things like poetry, income tax, and weapons of mass destruction. So there's not a lot of energy in lightning, sorry.
Okay.
That surprised me. I thought there'd be more energy with that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ellie.
Awesome.
Someone's texted in off the back of the solar eclipse burning the retina question. Someone's saying, that's surely not any different to glancing at the sun on a normal day, right? Ooh. How is it different?
I guess it's different in the sense that when the sun is bright, you look at it and your instinct like, I'm going to look away. Like your instincts tell you to do that.
Oh.
Whereas when it's so thin and it's just got a crescent left, it's still, you're looking at it and it's less of that instinct of, this is actually still fine.
Yeah.
But your eyes are still getting damaged. There's not that instant pain. That's where I would guess.
Or that kind of,
is that
the
issue?
Like there's a moment where you kind of, it just tips you over the edge.
Instantly, I really shouldn't do this anymore. But when it's in near totality but not quite totality yet, it's still so dark.
Wow.
It's like, this is fine.
And like it's looking at a laser beam, having somebody shine a laser beam.
Well, don't
your
do
eye.
That. Yeah, don't
exactly.
like that.
So that's really small and it won't make you look away. But if you keep on staring for more than a second, bingo.
Brenton in Newborough, what do you want to know?
Probably my serious question. Aliens, are they real?
Ah, Brenton, there's always one. And I love it. I love this question every single time because for me personally, I reckon there's something out there, but not here. So let me preface in saying that it's a big universe out there. We are one of maybe 2 trillion galaxies, of which there are hundreds of billions of stars in these galaxies. We believe there could be at least one planet for every star in the universe. That's a heck of a lot of planets. And if we're the only one that has life on it, that's pretty unlikely. So I think there could be life somewhere out there. Maybe it has existed. Maybe it's still existing now. I'm not sure. I hope we find it one day or signs of it one day. But do I think that aliens have visited us and there are UFOs all hanging around? I don't think we're that special to be visited by people.
All right, Brenton, that's your answer for this guest.
And Brenton, there's a whole question on this called the Fermi Paradox on Wikipedia. Mm. And Fermi's at lunch with all his people and he says, where are they? And everybody immediately knows he's talking about the aliens. Read the article in Wikipedia, and it runs through many possibilities.
It's very good. Can recommend it. Yeah.
Where are these aliens? Okay, next question.
All right, we've got Tim in Melbourne. Tim, you've got a question about food.
G'day, doctors. How are you?
Good.
Just a question, about food. How do we know that all foods taste the same for different people? So, for example, do bananas taste the same to you that they do to me?
We can tell how you see colours the same by shining individual specific colours, not the whole band as white, but just sort of like a red, you know, like 1 nanometer wide, etc. And then we can pick up electrical signals off the retina from each of the three different types of cones that pick up colour and say, you are responding to red as much as everybody else does. However, 2 to 10% of males, depending on where you are on the planet, are colourblind in the sense that they have sensors that will pick up blue, but not red and green. Either red or green, but not both. And we can pick that up. We can say, okay, we know what you're seeing. I have not read studies where people have stuck needles into people's tongues to find out how their individual five different classes of taste receptors respond. So if somebody has the answer to that, ring in next week with an answer. So I haven't got a good answer for you on that.
We'll have to see. We've got Halcyon in Sydney now. Halcyon, what's your question for Kirsten?
Hi. So there's all these amazing stories and First Nations cultures about the night sky. And I was just wondering what Dr. Kirsten's favourite story is and how it relates to what she knows about the science.
Oh, thank you so much for asking this question, because I myself am a proud Wiradjuri woman, and I want to share with you my favourite constellation from my Wiradjuri heritage, which is Gugulmin. We call it Gugulmin, and it is the dark emu people may know it by. So when you look up into the night sky, you're not seeing a constellation in the sense of connecting the dots between stars or connecting the lines between stars. Instead, you're looking at the dark parts of the Milky Way galaxy, and within that, you can see a bit of an emu shape from areas with very little light pollution. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's fantastic. But the way it relates to science is how the world works around us. We see Gugulmin and its different position in the night sky to indicate what emus are doing currently, whether they are running around looking for a mate or nesting with eggs ready for us to collect to be able to eat.
Wow, so it aligns with their cycle as well.
It does, yeah. For the last tens of thousands of years,
That's incredible.
A great way. It's seasonal menu, so to speak.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much for your question, Halcyon.
Very cool.
Hey.
Thank you.
You have a bunch of different places where you answer people's questions on the regular, Kirsten. Where can we find you? Where can we find what you're up to?
You can find me at Astro Kirsten on all the socials. I'm on TikTok, I'm on Instagram, I'm on YouTube, trying to push out more long-form content on YouTube now. So if you want more of a deep dive into some topics in astronomy, you can find me there. And also on Facebook too, if you're still out there too.
If you're still on there, all right. Astro Kirsten.
Astro Kirsten is me.
Wherever you get it. Thank you so much for joining us. Science with Dr. Carl.
My pleasure. Thanks for all the awesome questions from everyone who called and texted in. That was so much fun.
So good. Every week. Carl, I'll catch you next week. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. And we've got plenty of guest episodes on Spaced for you to tuck back into. Just take a scroll through the podcast feed. Make sure you're subscribed. My name is Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Sarah Harvey. And we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.